and welcome to another exciting episode here at IT Pro TV. I'm your host, Mike Roderick, and today we're going over CISSP, and specifically we're looking at risk management. Previous episode, we've got the basic concepts of risk management down, a lot of the terminology that's going to make going through risk management and risk analysis a little bit easier for us to talk about, to understand, and to prepare for that exam. But there's more to it. We did not get through all of it, so Adam Gordon is here with me to help us work our way through risk management. So where do we go next, Adam?
So I was thinking we would do a vocabulary review and that Mike, while standing on one foot, would recite for us all the definitions of all the risk terms that we went through. How many of you want to see that? That would be awesome, personally. I think that would be good. We're not going to subject you to that, however. What we are going to do is just quickly remind you of a couple of things, all kidding aside, and then we're going to jump back in and talk about some of the stuff that we have on the agenda for this particular episode. So we have talked a lot about not just how to quantify and qualitatively assess risk, but generically what risk is, right? And we spent a lot of time developing the thought process about what all the moving parts, the vocabulary of risk is. And I would encourage you to go back and review the language discussion. Make sure you know what a threat source is. Make sure you understand what a vulnerability is. Make sure we know what a threat event is and how a vulnerability being exploited leads to a likelihood of impact that could be measured either quantitatively or qualitatively, the two methods we use to assess risk. And the four mechanisms or ways in which we use to address risk. They are going to be risk acceptance, again, no particular order, risk acceptance, risk avoidance, risk transference, and risk mitigation. I want to make sure we remember those four things as we begin our conversation here. We also want to make sure that we understand and we remember that when we are dealing with risk, however we deal with it, we accept it, we mitigate it, we transfer it, we avoid it, there's always something left over, right? My grandmother would always tell me, hey, always leave something on the table, right? Don't eat everything there. So as a result, you always leave something behind. Risk, whatever condition it's in, however we deal with it, ultimately whatever we call it, is going to be left over. If we quantify that leftover risk, we call it risk. What kind of risk do we call it?
Risk leftovers.
Risk leftovers, right. Warm them up, 300 degrees, a little bit of water so they're a little tender.
Residual
We call
risk.
Them, exactly. We call them residual risks. Want to make sure we know that residual risks are going to be the leftover risks, right? Very important. This is why, gentlemen and ladies, you never practice information security without a net, right? Because it is live when we do this for you. And as a result, sometimes it works well, and other times, well, you know, throw the ball in the air, and guess what happens? You get leftovers. That's how it works. All right, so residual risk, very important as a terminology item as well. So risk assignment, right? Let's talk about now that we know, we remind ourselves of the fact that we always have something left over. So we have risk, we've identified it, we're trying to deal with it, we have something there that we have to deal with. How are we going to do that? Do I just say, hey, somebody should go deal with that risk? Do I give it to somebody? I usually am in the habit of, at least I am, and most of us should be, in the habit of assigning risk to somebody and saying, Mike, this is your risk. I need you to deal with this. This is going to be something you ultimately are going to be responsible for. So risk assignment becomes very important. That's a central theme inside of how we deal with risk in the conversation in the organization. Ultimately, the organization owns risk, but the reality is somebody has to represent the organization, step up and say, guess what? I am the person, I am the entity that's going to manage this risk on behalf of the organization. And when we say the organization ultimately owns risk, let's be clear, what do we really mean? Well, we really are saying, right, without coming right out and saying it, and I'm about to come right out and say it, but what we are saying and implying is not that the nameless, faceless entity called the organization owns risk, not that an individual named Mike or Adam owns risk on behalf of the organization, but specifically that a nameless, faceless entity called the organization is represented by senior management. And senior management owns the responsibility of the risk, and they assign that risk, the responsibility, to one or more individuals, typically a CISSP or some sort of manager on behalf of them that will walk through the process of figuring out how to address the risk on behalf of the organization. But let's be clear, let's be unequivocal. Senior management ultimately bears responsibility for risk. If something goes wrong, we're going to come back and talk to senior management. If there is ultimately financial liability associated with risk, we're going to lay that at the feet of senior management on behalf of the organization. So we want to make sure we understand that. Everything begins and ends with senior management. Still want to be a CISSP? Just asking, that's all. So anyway, please make sure we understand that and we're aware of that. Senior management is where accountability and responsibility lie. with regards to risk and risk assignment. However, they will devolve that right down in the organization, push it down broadly and laterally, and ask other individuals to take that on behalf of the organization. This is where due care and due diligence come back in, because this is how we then ultimately see the management of risk evolving over time. To that end, we've talked already, and I'll remind you yet again, about enterprise risk management guidelines and standards that exist. And when we talk about something more than once, right, it's a good hint that there's probably value there. I did make clear to you that we don't expect you to go out and become an expert on ISO 31000, but that you should have passing familiarity, passing awareness of the fact that there are ISO standards dealing with risk. I talked to you about ITIL. We talked about COBIT. We talked about COSO. These are all risk frameworks in one form or another, in one way or another. We talked about the NIST risk assessment process and a business impact analysis with regards to measuring the importance of services in a prior conversation that then helps us to identify and frame risk. All these things are important, but remember, we've often talked about mile wide and inch deep and the idea that you have to master knowledge at the appropriate level in order to become a CISSP. So when we talk about enterprise risk management guidelines, reminding you about the fact that COSO, that COBIT, that ISO or ISO 31000 or 27005, which is one of the earlier risk standards, exist. I'm just doing that off the top of my head. When all of those come out, we want to remember those. We want to be aware of them. But are you going to be asked questions specifically about what's in ISO 31000? Absolutely not. Unless you pay for the standard, number one, you're not going to be able to read it. And number two, nobody said go out and buy the standard so you can then study for and take the exam. But should you be familiar with the fact that ISO addresses risk? Absolutely. As a CISSP, we definitely have to understand and abide by that particular level of information and knowledge. So when we think about enterprise risk management guidance, we think about frameworks that are available to us as practitioners and as policy managers. We want to reference those and make sure we are aware of them. When we think about these different components coming together, we have to think about how they're going to help us to manage risk. So when we think about identifying risk, right, we've walked through this. We've talked about business requirement gathering and requirements analysis and all the things that go on. We have to think about risk from a lot of different perspectives. When I talk to customers about identifying risk, you know, it's easy to talk about the things they know. Hey, what are the risks you face in your business today? Oh, we're worried about people hacking into our customer database and stealing our account information. Okay, we hear about that all the time on the news, right? People talk about that. That happens to big and small companies. And so that's one that's pretty common, right? People know about that. So that's an important one. That's an obvious one. What about the ones that aren't so obvious? What about what are they going to do with that data once they take it from you? Because let's assume hypothetically that they're going to be able to take the data. Is that the end of the risk and are you done? You get to go home? I mean, that would be nice in theory, right? We're done, didn't end well, but, you know, hey, come back tomorrow, we'll try again, right? It's not a game show, so you don't get to come back and try again. So if somebody takes the data from you, the next risk is can they access the data and use it? So we may have controls in place that will encrypt the data. And so even though the access controls to the data may not have been very sound, very robust, very good, and they may have fallen prey to an attack that allowed the data to become compromised, if somebody can't access the data because it's encrypted and they can't break the encryption because we used a very strong encryption solution, then we've still done our job. I don't mind if somebody takes my data if they can't do anything with it. Now, I do mind. Let me be clear, right? My customers mind, I mind, because the impact of that is that you're not going to trust us as a customer, as a business to host your data, and that sword of Damocles that we talk about is always hanging over your head, right? Will they be able to get into the data? Can they compromise the data if they break the encryption? I don't want to put that to the test unless absolutely necessary. But if it comes down to, hey, took the data but can't use it, I'd rather be on that side of the conversation saying, yeah, you took it, but oh well, so you got it, you can't use it, so who cares? I'd rather be able to tell my customers that and work on damage control with them and figure out how to help them tell their customers things will be okay than worry about whether that data is going to be taken and then used. So my point is we come back to a very basic but incredibly important concept here, defense in depth, right? We come back to the idea of overlapping, mutually reinforcing controls. Risk management, in other words, is not about getting it right one time. It's about a continuous thought process that evolves with the information, with the protection needs. And as we continuously evolve, we continuously are probing, monitoring, testing, but we're also building additional layers of protection into our system. So when you think about, and we didn't draw a a graphic for this, and we don't need one, but you can kind of see it off on the above my shoulder, off to the one side of the camera there, where you see the concentric rings or the edge of the concentric circles that are, let me point that way, that are over there. Totally counterintuitive pointing when I'm on camera going the opposite way. But if you kind of see it right over there, what I'm pointing to is a, you know, kind of a half shot, a quarter, or a pie kind of outtake of that, but it's a set of concentric rings or circles, right, that form a graphic on the back end of the stage here, right? And so the idea would be simply that we're almost looking at like a bullseye or the logo from Target. You can think of that if you have a mental image for that. It's just a set of concentric rings. The idea with behind defense in depth is just this. It's a series of concentric rings. And when we go and we try to get into, as a bad actor, the first level or first area of ring of controls, we may bypass that, right? We may get around that. We may get into the second layer. And ultimately, if I do it this way and we, you know, kind of continue to move down, if I can penetrate all the layers, I may get to the data down below, right? But if I get stopped somewhere in the middle and I never get below to the data, then I've been successful in terms of the architecture. You know, one of the most important quotes I ever read and I ever heard about with regards to data and data security and risk, and it stuck with me all these years, is not about the fact that you need to build these control layers, these defense in depth mechanisms, and you have to be great at architecture and all these things. All that's good. Got to do all that. But the reality is we have to do that because controls are bypassed, right? They're not attacked. People just go around them. Reality is we build these fixed environmental controls. We put doors in place and put locks on them, right? We put alarms on doors. We use bulletproof or crash-resistant barriers in the front of our data centers, bollards and things like that to prevent people from getting in. We do all that. So what do people do? Right? They come around the back of the building, they find an open window, they crawl in, and they go take our data when nobody's looking. So the reality is that for all the planning we do up front, it's still going to be the weakest link in the chain. And that's what the conversation and the quote is about you do all this work up front, but if you don't really have a complete encompassing set of environmental, logical, and technical and administrative controls, all the control elements, we'll talk about one of our upcoming episodes. If you don't have all of those, you know, you might as well do nothing. You got nothing, because the reality is somebody's going to figure out a way to come along and take it from you, right? And so this is really important. All these frameworks we're talking about, they're all good. But if you use all of them, and at the end of the day, you put them all in place and say, I'm just going to throw everything up on the wall. Something's going to work. You're going to have a hodgepodge. That's an official information security term, by the way, hodgepodge. You can use that, but only after you're certified. Don't use it until then. But you have a hodgepodge of all this stuff. But do you really have a plan? Do you have a holistic solution? Do you have controls that are mutually reinforcing, overlapping, and are going to provide additional layers of security? You may or may not. My teenage daughters call it a hot mess. I think that's what the proper terminology is today. You have a hot mess, right? And that's what you have. You don't have, in other words, a holistic solution. You don't have a security ecosystem. What you have is a bunch of garbage that may or may not be related to each other. And as a result, it's not really very strong. And the first strong attack that comes across is probably going to take that system away from you. That's going to be an issue. So when we think about countermeasure selection, what we have to think about is what are the things that are going to make countermeasures meaningful to us, right? So if I say to Mike, you've got a problem, right? And we got to figure out how to solve that problem. So we have to first identify the problem. We've walked through that exercise in a prior episode. Mike was kind enough to help me figure out how to do requirements analysis. And he said, hey, my problem is I want to keep people that aren't authorized from seeing the content in the content library at IT Pro TV. Because we want the people that belong there seeing it, but we don't want the people that don't belong there seeing it. Okay, no problem. We've got a requirement. We understand that. So how are we going to prevent that from happening is the conversation. Countermeasure selection is about the things we will do in order to prevent the bad people that don't belong here from getting access to the system. So we talked about the fact we may use a dual or multi-factor authentication solution, not just a username and a password, but we will require people that are authorized to come in and see the content to have that, but also use some other form of authentication. Maybe we will communicate with you out of band and send you a code of some kind, a PIN, that you have to then put into the system along with your username. A lot of banks, financial institutions do this today as a use of dual factor authentication so that they can validate not just you, but the fact that you have a piece of knowledge that only you should have if they communicate with you and you have your email address or your phone number or whatever on file ahead of time. Then when we send it to you via SMS text, in theory, it's going to your number. If your number hasn't been compromised, you may have the username as a bad actor and you may have the password, but if you don't have the PIN, you can't get in. Mike's already scheming and thinking, well, that's good. We should do that. Something we're going to start doing, right? So we may have dual-factor authentication. That may be a good countermeasure selection for us. We may also decide we want to implement something known as biometrics. We may actually have everybody implement some sort of a fingerprint scan or a voice scan or any number of things that would involve something you are, right? Another factor of authentication. So we may do a retina scan or an iris scan, who knows what. Point is, if we implement that, that's going to be even tougher for somebody to hack into and fool, because they would have to have a copy of your fingerprints. Or if you ever saw the movie The Minority Report, you would, I'm not going to go into graphic detail, but just remember the baggy episode, right? This, the whole thing with the bag, right? So you would have the ability to be able to present yourself as somebody by being able to effectively scam the system into pretending that it's really you and believing you. So you'd have to present some sort of physical evidence that shows you're really that person, whether it's an eyeball or a finger or whatever it is, you get the idea. So when we think about countermeasures, right, we're thinking about the way in which we want to offset the risk, right? Come up with a plan, a mechanism, a control, one or more, that's going to help us to prevent the risk from occurring. So we want to think about, when we think about countermeasure selection, we want to think about accountability, we want to think about auditability. Is the countermeasure we're going to choose auditable? Can we look at it? Can we measure it? Can we tell how good it is over time? Because if we can't audit it, how do we know it's being implemented correctly? Think about that. That can be an issue, right? Whether we trust the source it's coming from or not. So if we say to everybody, hey, you're going to give us a fingerprint as part of the application process, and we're going to use that fingerprint stored in a database, and then when you become a member, you're going to have to provide that fingerprint through a fingerprint reader we send you, right? Ronco fingerprint reader, 1995, only today. So if you have to provide that scan in order to validate your identity along with your username and password, do we trust you? We have to establish that. What level of trust do we have? Is it cost effective for us to send you fingerprint readers and for you to provide a fingerprint scan to us? Probably not very cost effective, right? How secure is it? Can we manage the fingerprints? Can you provide them securely? Can we validate it's really you providing it, not somebody that's provided it on behalf of you? These are all things that you want to think about. My youngest one, my little daughter, right? So she has a new iPhone. And the new iPhone has the fingerprint reader, right, technology on it, right, which is important, I guess, in some circles, in theory, for certain things. I don't buy into the whole idea of consumer electronics that have that kind of authentication. I think that's just a gimmick and a waste. But, that's me. I'm a BlackBerry person, so take from that what you will. But having said that, she has a fingerprint scanner on her phone. So she enabled it, right, and we set it all up, and she said, Daddy, let me show you how this works, which is important when you have the 12-year-old showing you how technology works. And she got it right, which was even more impressive. Fantastic. But she set it all up. So she turned it on. It was working for like a day. Comes to me the day after we gave her the phone. Says to me, hey, by the way, it's not working anymore. What's wrong with it? So I now realize what I'm good for. Not for setting things up, but for fixing them when they break, right? This is what 30 years in IT security gets you, the ability to troubleshoot an iPhone when it breaks. So she says, hey, it's not working, right? Why is it not working? I said, I don't know. I use BlackBerries. I don't use Apple. So, I don't know. But let's figure it out. So we looked, and what we ultimately found is that it wasn't that it was not working. It was that her uncle had turned it off, doing something else to help her set up another feature in the phone, and forgot to turn it back on or forgot to tell her to turn it on. And so the ability to use that was still perfectly fine. It was intact. It was working in the system. It just was turned off for a period of time. Sometimes countermeasures can be easy to disable, and maybe that's not a good thing. Maybe if you could turn it off easily when you're updating some other feature in the phone, then that's not such a good countermeasure. It's not such a good authentication mechanism. In her case, it really turned out to be not so good because she wasn't able to use it. Luckily, she had her passcode and whatever other garbage they make you use to log on to the phone. Anyway, so we have all that, right? So does the control leave, or the countermeasure rather, leave residual data behind? Implementing a control or a countermeasure can actually lead to other exposure if we're not careful. So for instance, let's say that we use a network-capable print device, one of those multifunction all-in-one devices. So we now send all of our data to the multifunction printer instead of the printer that was attached to our computer on the desk, because that's now the new standard and that's what we do. Well, that's okay. Nothing wrong with that. We get up, we get a little exercise, we walk over to the printer, we have a chat, we get some coffee, that's all good. But what happens with the data that's sent to the device? Is it stored there residually after we print? In most cases in these devices today, they have onboard hard drives. They will render that information, store it in the hard drive, and then we have to think about as a security professional whether we are encrypting that data or whether we are wiping it after the transaction. And what about when somebody comes to maintain that device and takes the drive out to put a new drive in, the vendor? What happens with all that data that's sitting on that drive? That may be confidential company proprietary information that is stored encrypted in the file systems where it's kept, but not stored encrypted at the printer where we actually printed it. That could be a huge issue, right? So these are things we have to think about. Residual data can be a major, major problem for us in terms of countermeasures and how we select them. This is all things that, unfortunately, or fortunately for us, if we think about them ahead of time, but unfortunately, if we don't, can come back to haunt us. As CISSPs, you know, we got to master a lot of stuff. We got to think about a lot of stuff. Every time somebody touches the system, every time they do something, there's potentially a liability, potentially a risk associated with that action. It's our job to ensure that they can do those things safely and securely, providing confidentiality, integrity, and availability along the way. But if we're not up to that task, we have a problem. You know, I often say to my students and my customers when I talk with them about this, and they ask me, you know, how do we get good at security? I mean, this is a conversation I have all the time. How do I get good at security? Well, there's a long answer and a short answer to that. The long answer involves you becoming, you know, basically a multi-year veteran of this environment and being able to master those skills by doing them over time. But most people want the short answer, the easy path, right? And so what I say is, well, if you don't want that, then here's the other answer. The short answer is you've got to be able to be this much better, right? And what I'm showing you is that there's a very, very small space between my two fingers right here. This much better than the person that's coming to attack you. And everybody says, oh, that's not hard. I can do that. That much better when they're attacking me? Like, I can do that, right? That's easy. That's all you do, right? I mean, that's it? Yeah, I do a little bit more than that. Here's why. Because you got to be this much better, but the trick is you got to be this much better 24/7, right? Now, it may be easy to be this much better every so often and get lucky, right? But if you're that lucky, you're not listening to this. You're out winning the lottery, and you're living on an island somewhere, and you own a really big ship, right? And you should hire me and Mike to come do security for you.
Absolutely.
Because that's our dream. We want to go do that. But if you are not that person, and most of us are not, the exception of that guy. You heard about that guy that won the lottery twice?
No.
Recently?
Twice?
So, twice. So not just twice. He won the lottery. 30 minutes later, won another lottery.
Holy cow.
Holy cow. That's the right thing we have to say. This is a family environment, right? Family fun, family clean environment. He won the lottery twice within 30 minutes. If you're not that guy, I'm not that guy. If you're not that guy, then you want to make sure that you don't use luck as your methodology for managing risk, is what I'm saying to you. Because the reality is most of us are not that lucky. And even if we are, reality is at some point luck runs out, right? If our methodology for managing risk is I'm going to use luck, I got news for you, right? You're not going to be doing this very long. This is not a good career choice for you. You need to rethink your options, and this may not be a good solution for you, right? And I know you know that. I'm only being facetious. My point is we've got a plan to be this much better than the people that attack us. And we got to work incredibly hard to do this, because by doing this, they go and they attack somebody else down the road. That sucks for them, but guess what? You're not them, right? If they don't get it and they're not this good, then that's bad for them. Tell them to come watch this show and tell them to learn how to be this much better, and then it'll be somebody else's problem, right? If we all pay it forward, in other words, the world will get ultimately be a much more secure place. Mike and I will have to start talking about other stuff, right? I make a really good cup of espresso and a really mean gin and tonic. We can talk about that some other time. All right, so countermeasure selections, right? This is important stuff. Why is this important? Because if you don't know the questions to ask, if you don't understand how to measure the value and understand the value of the countermeasures you're implementing, how can you possibly tell me that they're going to be successful? And more importantly, how can you possibly tell me they're going to address the requirements I have to fix my security problems? I don't know, and neither do you, and that's the problem. So you got to ask these questions. You got to understand what you're doing. Design considerations, in other words, for architecting secure solutions are complicated. You got to think about the entire system as well as all the parts that make it up. You know, we often say that the solution is not just the parts, but it's greater than the sum of the parts, and that's very true. It's especially true here. Security is not about getting the firewall in place and putting in the deny all rule. That's easy. What about if I go around the firewall? Then the firewall has absolutely no bearing on this conversation. And while it is denying everything, I'm not putting anything through it. So it's got nothing to do. If I don't have another control mechanism somewhere else, that firewall is irrelevant. It's not helping me. And if I use defense in depth and you say, okay, Adam, but you told me, so I got the firewall, but I also got the IDS and the IPS and they're in line. Great, I'm going to go around all three of them. What do you got for me next? You know, this is the conversation we're going to talk about, right? And this is how it evolves. For everything we put in place as a countermeasure, a determined hacker has a solution to bypass that. That's the problem, right? That's when I talk about being this much better, why it's so tough. Because for every solution, every countermeasure, there is an equally effective counter to the countermeasure. If somebody's that determined, they're going to come take things away from you. good security professionals, smart people that become CISSPs that know how to do this the right way, understand you have to invest a lot of time and energy up front to ensure that you build as secure a solution as possible. Architecture is important, and good architecture is paramount to success. But you also need to understand that good architecture only gets you so far. And at the end of the day, while good design is important, good design is not always going to win the day. Let me share with you a quick anecdote about good and bad design. So without naming names, there is a very famous car manufacturer. Some of you may buy and use their products. They are the pinnacle of the driving experience, if you will. So that car manufacturer, along with other car manufacturers, to be fair, not just this one I'm thinking about, but the story happened to be about this one, have recently, over the last several years, with convergence and the idea of converging IP technologies into things like automobiles, have put USB ports into their cars to allow for enhanced not only diagnostics to be run on the car, but to IP-enable cars. Tesla, for instance, is IP-enabling, wireless-enabling their cars for software updates and firmware and things like that. And many of the car manufacturers at that end of the market are. Mercedes does, BMW does. Things like that are fairly common today. So this particular car manufacturer had a maintenance port, a USB port, installed on the inside of their cars that would allow for you to plug in as a diagnostic tool, a special tool that would run diagnostics on the car, examine the whole system of the car, including the, you ready for this drum roll? Security system. See where I'm going with this? So big, huge, couple of years ago, big, huge rash of auto thefts start happening in Europe, because of the fact that somebody figured out that if they could gain access to this port, they could disable the security systems in the car and drive the cars away. So what would they do? Get a wire coat hanger or a Slim Jim, pop the lock on the car. All they had to do was insert a thumb drive with a very specific piece of malware and a program that would execute and disable the security routines in the car. Now, I'm making it seem incredibly simple. There's more to it than that. You obviously have to know what you're doing to do this, but the point is, it obviously wasn't that hard because they stole a whole bunch of these cars in a very short amount of time. So sometimes good design with the best of intentions can actually not turn out well. And there's no substitute for common sense, as we often say. And we talk about this with regards to security. When we think about securing and building countermeasures and being able to deal with risk and all the things we're talking about, we often talk about making sure that we secure early and secure often. Meaning, from the very beginning of the process, of anything you're involved with, always be thinking about what can we do better and differently to make this a more robust solution. And if we test that and push the boundaries of that thought process, we're going to find things that don't make sense. The challenge for the CISSP is feeling confident enough to challenge the assumptions in the business and point out the fact that maybe some of the things we're doing are not really all that sensical, and maybe there's a better way. And if we can do that and have the dialogue about that, and again, let me be clear, in positive terms, you don't walk in and say, hey, this is stupid, what are you doing? But you have to have a positive dialogue about the fact there may be a better way to achieve the same end result. And have we looked at or tried this or that? If we do that, I'm not suggesting every time that dialogue ends well, but I'm suggesting that you have to be willing to push that dialogue up to the upper levels of the organization to have that dialogue exposed so that we can identify risk and as a result of that, deal with it in a proactive way. This becomes very important when we're thinking about all of these concerns that we have, if you will think about those things and think about what security actors and good actors have to do. So think about this for just a moment. Think about the biggest security problem you currently face in the workplace today. Whatever it is, physical, logical, doesn't matter what it is. If it's a personnel issue, if it is a software security issue, if it is a hacking concern, take your pick. I don't know what it is, and it doesn't really matter. I'm just asking you to think about what that is. Think about then, from that perspective, if you've identified what that is, what would be the most appropriate countermeasure? If money was no object, if constraints were not an issue, there were no politics, there was no culture of no, you can't, but rather there was a culture of, wow, that may be a good idea. Let's figure that out and see if we can do that. Just for a minute, hypothetically, what would that countermeasure be? What would you suggest? I'm not saying that tomorrow morning you walk into the organization you work for and try to reinvent the world. I'm just pointing out to you that when there are no boundaries that you have that are preconceived and you talk to people about issues and concerns, you have very different outcomes. And the answer may still be no, but I promise you that conversation goes a long way towards fixing those issues, even if the immediate answer is not going to be positive, than it does if it never happens. And if you have that conversation as a CISSP, it carries a lot of weight with the organization because you are the perceived expert. You're supposed to know that this is a good or a bad idea. And if it's not the best way, you should be prepared. And let me be clear, be prepared with an alternative. Don't just simply say, hey, this is a problem, right? As my boss of many, many years is fond of reminding me, right? Don't come to me with problems. Come to me with an identification of a problem, but most importantly, offer me a solution. And if you offer me a solution, then we can have a dialogue about whether or not we can change. And this is really ultimately the most important opportunity for you to think about with regards to risk, which is the opportunity to have the conversation about what we can do differently to deal with risk within the organization, right? Very important.
Very good. All right, Adam, a lot of great stuff for us to think about and a great in-depth look at risk management and choosing controls, implementing those controls, not just implementing them, implementing them, if I can say that, properly. Fantastic. We thank you for that, Adam. Remember, if you want to check out Adam or want to attend one of his classes live, shoot us an email. That's right. Shoot him an email or shoot us an email at cadam@itpro.tv. Signing off, I'm Mike Roderick.
I'm Adam Gordon, and remember, may the risk always be with you. See you later.